Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. It's a new year. Happy New Year. It's in the news. I'll dive into the news stories that we've been looking at in recent weeks. Hope you had a joyous festive season. And with me, as always, is John Stevens, our National Director. Hello, John.
Hi, Phil. Happy New Year, everybody.
Excellent. And Adrian Reynolds, our Head of National
In the words of ABBA, Happy New Year.
Right. I'm still eating Twiglets. Did you have a good Christmas?
Yeah, it was all right.
Yeah. Did Twiglets feature?
No, I can't eat Twiglets. I'm a celiac.
Oh, of course. Very
so
sad.
Thank you for just, you know, rubbing,
yeah,
that,
rubbing that in. Yeah. I get a tub of Twiglets every year and they've only just been consumed. Very exciting.
Twiglets for me, it's more like love it or hate it. Yeah. Hate it. I'm no, counting, thank you very much. But had a great Christmas. Thank you.
I'm counting down to next year. No, this year.
Excellent.
Only 300, oh, whatever.
Whatever it is. Well, we've had a very busy start to the year. Adrian, you've been at Growing Young Disciples this week. Just tell us a little bit about that.
So Growing Young Disciples is a parachurch organisation run by Mel Lacey and a few others that serves youth workers and children's workers in churches like ours. They do a great job. About 450 people there this week at a three-day conference, resourcing, equipping, encouraging. Just really heartening to see a growing number of FIEC churches making use of that. Mm. And just people being given really good, solid grounding. Very often people going into youth work and children's ministry right at the beginning of ministry, they're not always particularly well-trained or given lots of input. So it's just good to see them getting really good help and encouragement. So a hugely heartening time.
And this afternoon, we'll be heading off to our Hub conference. John, you're coming as well, I think, to the Hub, which is our training conference.
Yeah, I'm going to the Hub conference we've been running for a number of years. It's a real desire is to want to raise up a next generation of leaders for independent churches in particular, kind of pastors, youth workers, women's workers. So covering the range of leadership needs in churches. It's a chance for people to come and think about God's call on their life, whether God is perhaps calling them into ministry, to help them to think about what steps they would need to take, what training's available, routes into ministry, funding for that, and to gather around under God's word. So we're delighted that Graham Thompson from Spen Valley Church is going to be coming and preaching God's word kind of to us, just reminding us all about the kind of the great task of the gospel. And quite a lot of our staff are part of the Hub Conference team, which gives us an opportunity to meet with people individually, just to help talk through with them where they're at in their life at the moment and give them any advice that would be helpful to them. We're not making decisions, but we are seeking to help people think things through well, and to encourage people to think about giving their lives to the service of the gospel in independency.
And John Samuel, who recently retired as pastor of Duke Street Church in Richmond, he's become our local director for Hampshire and Dorset, serving us one day a week in his retirement.
He has. Yeah.
He started this week. So welcome to John, and churches in that neck of the woods will be able to engage with him. And thank you to you, our listeners, because in 2023, the podcast was played 36,000 times. That's good, isn't it? I mean, 35,000 of them was my mum. But apart from that, we can be very encouraged.
It is great. I mean, I was preaching at a church, I was preaching at Whitcomb Baptist Church on Sunday last week. And it was just great to have a couple of people in the congregation come up and say, we listen to the podcast. Mm. We really appreciate it. Thank you for all we gain from it. So I think it's a really good way to connect with people.
Yeah, we're very grateful to the Lord in all seriousness. Thank you for listening. And let's talk about some of the news stories that have been dominating. It has not been a quiet start to the year for news, has it? So let's talk about what's happened with the post office. So this is a huge scandal, 700 plus sub-postmasters and mistresses wrongly convicted, it would seem, of fraud and theft and various other offences.
And many others accused.
Yeah, of course.
So
yeah,
it's not just
all because of a faulty piece of software. This is all now coming out into the light. And it's not. What's interesting about this is it's not a new story. This has been going on for several years, and the facts facts have been known for a lot of years, and in fact the inquiry's been ongoing. But it is this drama over the festive season, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office on ITV, that's really thrust this into the public eye.
Yeah, I mean, I think the inquiry was raising it, and you know, it was appearing in the pages of the news.
But this has put it to the front.
But it
page,
is the drama that ITV have shown, which I've watched, is a super drama, really good, four part, very moving. And it's a very, very engaging story because it is David against Goliath. You know, it's a small guy. Alan Bates, who's at the centre of the story, really has been very, very tenacious for the last 20 years, fighting the corner for these sub-postmasters and postmistresses that have been wrongly treated. I just want to pick you up on something that, Phil, it's not just the fault of the computer system.
Oh, it's loads behind it.
It's
a cover up.
It's a computer. It's an extraordinary cover up. You would almost not believe it unless there was the documentary evidence, because it requires different companies to collude. It would appear And we need to make it clear that actually the inquiry is not a criminal investigation, so we don't quite know what laws have been broken yet. But it certainly looks like it's a collusion. It looks like people have lied. It looks like people have covered their tracks. So it's an extraordinarily engaging story, but really one that just gets you very angry. And the number of people who have watched that and said, we're just really, really angry about it, which I think plays, you know, it demonstrates, doesn't it, the sense of justice that there still is. People really want there to be justice. And when they see injustice, especially when it's close to home, you know, we see injustice all the time around the world, but something that's really close to home, you know, everyone goes into the post office to send a parcel or to collect a pension or whatever it is. People know the post office. So when they see injustice close to home, people get very, very angry about it, and rightly so.
And post offices are a big part of communities up and down the country, aren't they? And there's some parallels with churches there as well, I think. People know kind of the local church, the local people involved in it. It's the same with the post office.
Yeah, in fact, some post offices are now in churches.
Well, exactly. So it just feels like it's a big part of community life, and that trust has been knocked over.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the post office has a special place in British life. It's a trusted brand. It was originally kind of an organ of the state. And I think for many people, the post office was one of those organizations that they relied on and that they trusted would be honest and would serve them. It was there to serve. And again, all of that trust has been undermined by the reality that what seems to be emerging here is that the post office has mistreated its own people, has sought to protect its own reputation, has been willing to lie, see people kind of sent to prison, knowingly. Aware that their own system was not working. Obviously, Fujitsu, the company itself, has also been protecting its own brand, failure to acknowledge the flaws in its systems, lying about the ability for sub-postmasters' accounts to be kind of changed from the outside. So that there appears to have been a total kind of cover-up of reality here that has allowed people to be significantly harmed as a result of that. It's not surprising, therefore, that the reputation of the post office has kind of suffered massively as a result of that. And a system has been revealed to be deeply kind of corrupt. And tragically, that is what we've seen in the church. I mean, one of the major factors with the decline of the church and Christianity in Western culture, particularly in the last 15, 20 years, has been the exposure of numerous abuses on the part of the church that have been covered up, where kind of leaders knew that abuse was taking place. Priests who were engaging in abuse were moved to new parishes without it being dealt with. We've seen that in the Catholic Church. Tragically, we've seen instances of that within the Evangelical Church, where there has been abuse, where the kind of the sort of perceived needs of the mission are put ahead of the misconduct of individuals. It's just another reminder to us that in the end, that ultimately destroys the reputation of the organization and the institution.
But why does that happen? Why is we're all sinners. Okay, fine. How is that allowed to happen in the church, in the post office? How can it just go to those levels? It just seems extraordinary to me.
Okay, who's going to answer that? You're looking sort of
I think that the reality is, yes, we know sometimes that our theology of sin is not strong enough. Yeah. But when you look at some of this stuff, you think, good grief, this is extremely difficult to understand how it could get like this.
I think, theologically, just to back up before we go into the instance, you know, to sort of actually the practicalities of what's happened, it is about total depravity. The sin does touch every part of life. But it's slightly more nuanced than that, because actually part of that total depravity is the heart's desire to self-justify.
And we all do that, don't we?
We all do that, yes. We all do that. And I think, you know, leaders especially need to be very careful about that. And that might manifest itself in different ways, but people doubling down, getting defensive, however it is. But basically people don't like to admit they've done something wrong. And I think we need to ask questions about our church leadership cultures, because it's very often difficult for a leader. Let's kind of row back a little bit and talk about things that aren't quite so serious. So in general, it can be very difficult for a church leader to admit a mistake because they feel it's perhaps, you know, undermines ministry. Perhaps people will see them as disqualified at some level, even when the sin isn't disqualifying. So we do have a culture actually where we're not very honest about wrongdoing and about making mistakes, where people are not quick to ask for forgiveness. And I think what we're seeing in the post office situation is that writ large. I mean, obviously, these are massive issues. I'm not trying to trivialize them at all. But I think we do have a culture of keeping quiet about wrongdoing and sin. We just don't want to admit it. So I think there's some of the theological things going on in the background.
I mean, we don't know people's hearts. We don't know what individuals have done in these circumstances. No. But I mean, I think it's worth recognizing there's probably a spectrum of involvement. So there are some people who are genuinely wicked, who are involved in this, who deliberately cover it up, knowing that it's wrong. I have no idea how they live with their consciences, but essentially they are sort of deliberate perpetrators of what's happening. There will be others who basically feel coerced into keeping quiet in these situations. It can be quite difficult to speak out against an organization or an institution. Your own position might be at risk. So you feel coerced, and maybe you justify to yourself, it's not my responsibility. And therefore you're willing to remain silent and in the situation. And you kind of, in a sense, say others are the ones who are making the real decisions. There are some people who will act out of a kind of a misguided sense of actually here in this situation, we need to protect the reputation of the organization, the kind of the greater good is deserving of that. And wonderful, they've deceived themselves into thinking that actually that is a sort of a right strategy. So
I think there's another level as well, John. Sorry, forgive me for interrupting, because there are those who have that there are sins of omission.
Yep.
There are people who didn't ask the right questions when they should have done. And again, that's a different category. Mm. So there are people saying, I should have asked more penetrating questions when I was given this information. And that's just another layer as well, isn't it, in terms of involvement?
Yeah, I mean, and I think actually just reflects the fact that sin operates at all of these different kind of levels. There are different levels of culpability, different levels of involvement.
Mm. A couple of observations about the drama, if I may. Three observations. Am I allowed 3 points?
It's not preacher. A couple anymore. It's a triplet, okay. But that's fine.
I just think that the telling of a story is very, very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just think in church life, we need more testimony. Actually, it just made me realize hearing people's stories, hearing how the Lord is helping people, hearing the struggles that people are going through. I just think that's a really important part of church life. You read the Psalms. Mm. The place of testimony is very, very powerful. And actually, I think if we over-formalize our services and our gatherings, we can easily lose the place for testimony. That's first observation. Second observation really is that this is being carried by Alan Bates. Mm. I mean, he is a hero. He really is a hero. Been very tenacious. He's been, arguing for, interceding for. I mean, I don't think it's too light a thing to say in this particular context. He's a something of a messianic figure. You know, he's arguing the case for people. He's standing up for them. He's standing in the breach for them. Hmm. It's a very, very powerful image. It makes you realize that if you're small and you're up against something that you can do very little about, you do need someone to stand in the breach for you.
You need an advocate.
You need an advocate. Hmm. And I just think that came across very powerfully. The third observation is, as you watch the drama, it's inescapable that Paula Venables, and we don't know exactly what her involvement is, that she's not appeared before the inquiry yet, but it's inescapable. It's made very clear she is a vicar in the Church of England. She's shown several times in a dog collar. She's shown sitting in church on her own, quietly praying. She's shown reading the Bible in church. And the particular passage they chose was very, they chose a passage about Solomon asking for wisdom. Mm. So it's made very clear that she is serving as a parish priest at the same time as she is CEO. And I just think there's a reputational issue for Christianity in general there that it's very hard to avoid, that we don't quite know yet what, if any, culpability she has. But it's very obvious the links, so that the narrative is strong in making those links for people in the world. And I think that's something that as Christians we're going to have to face up to.
Mm. I do think there are lessons in terms of the whole way this has unfolded. It's captured a cultural moment that suddenly this has become a massive story. And as a result of this drama, government is taking dramatic action very,
very
quickly.
Dramatic. Well, I was going to ask you about that. Well, maybe come to that, because as a lawyer, you might have a particular view on that. But anyway, yeah.
But I do think that it's important to remember it's not a new story. This has been around for a long time. This has been going on for years. There have been those like Mr. Bates who've been kind of raising these issues. There have been other journalists who've investigated. There was a Radio 4 kind of series looking in detail at what had happened. It didn't capture the public imagination in quite the way.
Computer Weekly and Private Eye were the main people who were driving it forward.
And I think that actually the drama, even the people who made the drama didn't necessarily think it was going to have this dramatic kind of effect. They were telling the story, but they didn't intentionally think this was going to suddenly kind of galvanize public opinion. I think there are kind of lessons in Christian ministry there. The gospel story is not a new story. And at one level, there are times at which we sort of plug away at telling the story, trying to communicate the story. Often that goes unnoticed. It might even go unnoticed publicly. And then there are just moments in time at which suddenly the story can resonate with the culture more widely. At one level, that's actually what happens generally in times of revival, is that sort of a story that's been being told just suddenly kind of enters into the public sphere and suddenly has a much wider impact and effect. And to some extent, it's not even in the control of those who are telling the story, and it's not intentionally done. And I think there's a lesson for us there. Much of the time in ministry at the moment, we are like Mr. Bates, we're like those other journalists, plugging away, telling the story, and it may not get a great deal of attention, but there may well be moments at which, just for all sorts of reasons, there's suddenly a much wider engagement with the story. And in a sense, we mustn't lose heart in the plugging away element of telling kind of the story.
And just very briefly, John, as a lawyer, your thought that Parliament could just quash a whole lot of legal convictions in one go, the precedent that sets, should we be concerned about that?
Well, I do think it's a unique situation. At one level, government has got to do something and act quickly, and the criminal cases review process is very slow. And they've clearly made a policy decision that in this instance, it would be better, because so many people have been clearly unjustly kind of convicted because of the Horizon scandal. They think it is better to recognise there may be some people who did engage in genuine fraud who will be cleared, for the sake of bringing quick comfort and compensation to the very large number of people who clearly their convictions would be unsafe. So it is unprecedented, but I think it recognises the difficulties of a criminal appeals process, re-looking at something like 900 plus kind of cases. Mm. Parliament has always had that power. It's not as if Parliament couldn't choose to do that. Ad doctrine of the sovereignty of Parliament entitles Parliament to be able to kind of say that. I mean, after all, it's been being sort of argued that Parliament should be able to declare Rwanda to be safe, even when the evidence suggests that it's not. So the power of Parliament to do that is there. But I think for most people, they would recognise this is a exceptional situation, and the need for speed after such a long period of time is really significant. I mean, again, I think from the perspective of the gospel, in the human world, it's a reminder to us that we can't do perfect justice here. Mm. You know, evidence is always difficult. We're making judgments. There will not be either perfect justice of acquitting all those who are innocent or convicting all those who are guilty. God's judgment in the end, and there will ultimately be a reckoning, it will be perfect justice, because he has perfect and complete knowledge of the reality of what everybody has kind of done. But we have to live in the fallen world with a best attempt at justice.
We're saying, for leaders, I think your people will be talking about this and communities will be talking about it. So I think at the very least, if you're able, you ought to watch the drama. I just think that's just wise
leadership
of people.
Yeah. Just staying in the corridors of power in Parliament, decision taken yesterday to involve militarily British jets and soldiers, fighters in the Middle East. So this has come out overnight, that there has been what the government have described as limited, proportionate and necessary attacks on Houthi rebel targets that have been attacking ships in a major shipping lane in the Middle East. Obviously, this has been linked to the Israel-Gaza conflict and all that's been going on there. How should we respond? It's not happening on our doorstep. How do we respond wisely to this? It's an escalation. People are concerned. People are rightly asking, what next? What does this mean for the wider region, Britain's involvement? Others saying, we've stepped in the past, it has not gone well. Is this a misstep? Initial reaction, it's new news, it's happened overnight.
Goodness, so many questions.
Well, there is, but take it in the direction you want, is what I'm saying.
I mean, I think it's a reminder, first of all, that the situation in the Middle East is highly complex.
Indeed.
And hasn't gone away. I mean, Israel-Gaza has slightly fallen off the headlines because of the post office Horizon scandal, but is definitely still there. And there's a lot happening even in that little theatre. Theatre as in it's kind of a war, technical war term. But also what's happening with Lebanon and Hezbollah, what's happening with Iran. I mean, Iran is sort of connects all of these things together. Iran are backing the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And also there's been a war going on in Yemen for some time that's virtually hardly makes any headlines. But actually there's been a big problem in Yemen. So I think it's worth seeing it in the context of a wider escalation. I think you're right to identify that. And we've got to keep making sure that it is on our, you know, our prayer agenda, and that we are helping people think about the world wisely. I think it's very difficult without the full knowledge of all the facts to make judgments about these things. Clearly, shipping has been attacked. That there are significant impacts being made on local economies, our local economy, because of what's happening in those shipping channels. So, for example, even this morning, this might not bother some people, but I read that Tesla are having to suspend production in Europe because they can't get parts for their cars because they're having to come around the Cape instead of going through the Suez Canal. So actually what's happening there is having an impact, not just locally there, but locally here. Mm. And that's the point, I think, at which governments start to think if something happens, we have to intervene, so that, you know, the talk of keeping the shipping lanes open and believing in free trade, it's all very noble, but actually it becomes quite, you know, it's quite personal, isn't it? When it's your ships being attacked, people with British passports being attacked, or actually British trade being impacted. So, I mean, it seems to be, I would say it seems to be proportionate at the moment, but without more detail, it's slightly difficult to say.
Parliament might be recalled. Would that be a wise thing to do?
I mean, it's worth recognising this. This is supported by the United Nations. There was a vote there.
Yeah, that's right.
This is part of a long history.
And other European countries have been involved in this.
It's part of a bigger kind of principle of wanting to maintain the freedom of the high seas for trade. It's in everybody's interest to do that. Actually, the area, the sort of the Arabian Gulf, the Red Sea, regularly shipping has been challenged and threatened. It might have been, on the one hand, Somali pirates kind of seizing ships. It's been Iran attacking ships at various points. There's been a regular need to, in effect, defend shipping and enable that to continue to flow. And I think this seems like a relatively limited action that's designed to enable that to be the case, which is largely supported by the wider world community. And it's a reminder to us that in the end, it is a role of government to basically seek to try to maintain order and to enable there to be kind of peace. And sometimes that is going to require the use of sort of force. I think there's no doubt that since the kind of almost the debacle of the kind of Iraq invasion and occupation, there's been much more reluctance to intervene. We're not living in a world in which the kind of neocon kind of invade and turn countries into democracies. That is long gone. So this is a sort of obviously a relatively small action taken at this stage. No doubt because the various countries feel pushed to the point where something has got to be done and they can't simply allow shipping to be attacked without response. It's an attempt to prevent further attacks.
Another story, brothers, that's relevant to Christians that's broken since the new year is that the Scottish government have produced their draft conversion therapy bill, which is going to go before the Scottish government. All sorts of comments have been made about it. John, you've printed it out and managed to read it this morning, which is extraordinary. I think one of the things it clearly seems to do is threaten free speech, particularly being able to talk to children about their feelings about their gender, sexuality, that kind of thing. It seems to impinge there. Am I overstepping, John, or is that what it's doing?
Well, as I was saying, this was published 4 days ago. It's been part of an ongoing kind of desire of the Scottish government to want to enact legislation to criminalise so-called conversion therapy, part of a bigger move to sort of do that across kind of Western countries. People have been sort of talking of the dangers of that for some period of time. Finally, this is an 84-page consultation document on what the Scottish government is kind of proposing. So I've had a chance to look at it. I wouldn't claim that I've got detailed knowledge of it. This is a first kind of look at it. And they're clearly determined to want to deal with the issue of what they see as being conversion therapy.
How are they defining it?
Yeah, they identify that as anything that seeks to either suppress or change a person's sexual orientation or kind of gender identity. So what's really interesting about it is it's not touching just on issues of same-sex attraction. It's also touching on issues of gender identity and transgenderism. The Scottish government recognises that there's a large amount of legislation that covers that already, but they clearly see this as a sort of a problem that needs to be sort of addressed. The LGBTQ community is relatively small in the UK. It's about 3% of the population. They say that about 5% of those people have experienced what they call harmful conversion therapy or the offer of conversion therapy. Interestingly, in the gay community, and many of those are actually older people, which sort of seems to suggest that this isn't something that's so current at the moment. There is a obviously greater concern actually about sort of younger people and a kind of gender identity and transgenderism. And in a sense, that seems to be a much more live area and is very complex in terms of kind of preventing people from either sort of suggesting that people shouldn't change gender or whatever. That's not universally supported by the gay community either. They claim that it's harmful, that it leads to lifelong sort of damage to people, PTSD on the part of those who've experienced some of these kind of behaviours. And it's interesting that they recognise, they sort of inadvertently sort of note that they think it's largely in religious communities. They say that 51% of the kind of conversion therapy practices have been within faith communities. So it's very clearly focused on kind of religious groups, Christians and others who believe that kind of people should live according to kind of God's standards of kind of heterosexual kind of marriage. So it introduces new offences. It's sort of in a sense seeking to criminalise those who have the purpose of seeking to either change or suppress people's sort of sexual orientation or kind of gender identity. Interestingly, the offences fall in two areas. One is basically practices that sort of seek to do this. And I think there the real danger for Christians is that they are saying they don't want to criminalize, for example, informal conversations that a religious minister might have with somebody. They don't want to criminalize sharing your views about sexuality and whether it's wrong. But as soon as that moves into some kind of active counseling,
therefore
of a person,
you should.
At that point, you are engaging in a practice. So as far as I can see on the surface of that, that might mean if somebody came up to you at church on kind of a Sunday and said, I'm suffering from same-sex attraction, what do you think about that? You could tell them what the Bible teaches, and that would not fall within their understanding of conversion practice. If you were to engage in counseling with them to enable them to suppress their sexual orientation, that seems to fall within the area of the legislation.
It's explicit about that. So in the section on suppression, it says, for e.g., telling someone who is same-sex attracted, or they don't use that phrase, but it was someone who is same-sex attracted, that they have to live a celibate life. That's a clear example they give of the offence of suppression.
So that would criminalise application of the Bible then, wouldn't it?
I mean, basically kind of active discipleship to help people.
When it's personal. So I think that they're still quite clear to say that if that's a pronouncement from the pulpit, in general terms, that doesn't break the law.
So sharing your views about sexuality and informal conversations, they want to exclude. But effectively, that's still going to criminalise a large part of personal discipleship and individual kind of Christian sort of ministry. And then the other side is coercion and control. Even those informal conversations can become criminal if they're in the context of a coercion and control of people to kind of cause them to live in a particular way. So I think on its surface, it kind of purports to try to be saying, we're not going to criminalize these kind of informal conversations that will maintain kind of religious freedom. You'll be able to express your views. But in effect, it seems to me that is going to be a massive restriction on the ability to be able to minister to and help people who are struggling with same-sex attraction, who want help to be able to resist that temptation. And that the penalties are quite severe. So it can be tried in a sort of equivalent of magistrate's court, and the penalty is 12 months imprisonment or a fine of £10,000. Or it can go to the equivalent of a kind of a crown court, and the penalty is 7 years in prison and an unlimited fine. So this is going to have a significant limiting effect on people's ability to engage in what we might call ordinary Christian ministry.
It's at consultation stage. If it becomes law in some form, is it likely to be used as a model by England and Wales? Any thought on that? Will it set a precedent?
Well, we don't have any idea what the kind of connections are between the kind of Scottish government and the sort of British government over that. There might be different opinions. So the views of the SNP in Scotland are actually quite different and would be more progressive than, say, some of the views that are being expressed by the current government in the UK. Kimmy Badenoch seems to perhaps have a slightly different perspective. on these things. So I don't think we could necessarily say that it's going to be exactly a parallel.
But it is a general election year.
But it is a general election year. And I think, you know, actually the Labour Party is probably much more supportive of a kind of a conversion therapy ban on a broader scale than the current government. Actually, the bigger question, I think, is does this actually fit with human rights law? I think organisations like Christian Institute have said that actually they will be willing to bring legal action, because I think there's a great danger that this is actually restrictive of religious freedom. Mm. And under the kind of Human Rights Acts, there is a right to both religious freedom and freedom of expression. And it seems that if this is cutting the ability of kind of religious groups to engage in a sort of discipleship, then there's an argument that that is actually unduly restrictive of religious freedom. And I think that's a case that needs to be brought and kind of made. So it may well be that these proposals are not compliant with the more general human rights legislation.
It's worth saying, if you're in Scotland, you ought to read it.
I was going to say, have you say.
It is a consultation. You ought to respond. They're asked, there's a list of questions that they provide that you can respond to. And I mean, I flicked through it this morning. There are things in it that I want to say amen to. And I think this is the problem with things like this, that actually there are extremes which are often held up as the sort of, you know, these what we're trying to clamp down on, to which you say, yes, we do want, you know, that probably is illegal already.
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, there are big sections about sending people abroad for conversion therapy and those sorts of things. And clearly there are some very dubious and unholy and ungodly practices that do need to be clamped down on. But as with all these things, it's everything getting wrapped together. When you make law, it's very difficult to make law for extreme cases without covering other cases as well, whether that's the intention or not. So they do say at the beginning, the intention is not to prohibit generally accepted pastoral practices, but then they go on to do exactly that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, yeah, definitely people must respond to it and have their say.
We will watch with interest. Brothers, time has beaten us. Go well at the Hub Conference this weekend.
Adrian, thank you.
You're preaching. I think, John, you're doing a seminar. I'm doing a seminar. We look forward to joining with you again in the next couple of weeks. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast, as we've taken a look at the news stories of the week. Do rate and leave a review so others can find it. And thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Phil. Thank you.